1992. The figure marked a further rise from the 30-year high of 9.3% hitch in September. Statistics Portugal said prices of energy products soared 27.6% year-on-year in October, while food costs jumped 18.9%, the highest since June 1990. The annual core inflation rate, which excludes energy and unprocessed food products, was 7.1% in October, up from 6.9% in September, the highest since January 1994. On a monthly basis, consumer prices ticked up 1.3% in October, following a 1.2% rise in September. Speaking at a recent press conference, European Central Bank ECB President Christine Lagarde said the likelihood of a recession in the Eurozone had intensified. Growth figures released on Monday, October 31st, showed a GDP, gross domestic product, figure of 0.2% for the euro area in October. This is after the region grew at a rate of 0.8% in the second quarter. Only Belgium, Latvia, and Austria registered GDP rates below zero so far. The 19-member bloc has dodged a recession, but an economic slowdown is evident. Several economists predict there will be a contraction in the GDP during the current quarter.
Dr. Syed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, a revolutionary fighter. On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks, including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system, is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950, when Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech, and I heard it on the radio. I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, "No matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them." The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. It's the mid-50s and Sayyid Muhammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allame Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the Religion and Knowledge School. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the religion and knowledge school in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Muhammad Dr. Beheshti, a doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesba Yazdi, and others to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brugerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brugerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brugerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brugerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. Savak doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, Savak documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's religion and knowledge school. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. Savak has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores Savak's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, Savak's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifiz military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Savak's blacklist because of the Mutalifiz, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man with so much ability to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the university students' union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much." The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti, Bahonar, and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous, but he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, "I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life." Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. "My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family." On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group, and in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions, from university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions, He's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is. What he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshi says, "We were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done." On April 1, 1974, Salvak writes in one of its documents, "Beheshi's employment and sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities." This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshi for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Savak asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's seminary school and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Manghul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter, a cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
While many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter, gas giant BP achieved an $8.2 billion in profits in the third quarter. Britain is facing a severe energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truthout wrote, the London-based oil and gas giant BP reported that it brought in a staggering $8.2 billion in profits in the third quarter, more than doubling its total from the same period last year, amid Europe's worsening cost of living crisis. The company announced it will be using its banner profits to buy back $2.5 billion worth of its own stock, rewarding shareholders as millions of people across the UK are having trouble heating their homes ahead of the winter season. According to the Financial Times, BP has repurchased more than $10 billion of its shares this year. The advocacy group Global Witness estimates that BP's $27 billion in profits over the past 12 months could pay the energy bills of 9.4 million UK households. Big fossil fuel firms making eye-watering profits is a slap in the face for the millions of citizens struggling to heat their homes, cook their meals, or buy everyday essentials, said Jonathan Noroha-Gand, senior fossil fuels campaigner at Global Witness, adding, as winter fast approaches, a dividing line is emerging. Whose side is the government on? Brits facing financial hardships or an industry that's making billions in profits off the current energy crisis? The UK's Conservative government unveiled a windfall profit tax on energy companies in May, but it has thus far had little impact on oil giants. Shell reported last week that it had paid nothing in windfall taxes in the country, and BP said it expects to fork over $800 million, a fraction of the gains it has reaped from global energy market chaos spurred by the Russia-Ukraine crisis. BP's latest earnings announcement sparked calls for a more aggressive windfall tax, as Jeremy Hunt, the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, is expected to unveil a new economic plan later this month. The Guardian reported that Hunt is considering increasing the windfall tax by up to 5 percentage points to 30% and extending its lifespan by 3 years to 2028. The government of new right-wing Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is also facing pressure to reverse plans for deep public spending cuts, which could be devastating for millions of people across the country. Freya Atchison, oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, said in a statement that the announcement of yet another obscene profit for a climate-wrecking oil firm highlights the scale of the pain that these companies are inflicting on the public. While fossil fuel companies are being allowed to make record-breaking profits, households are facing astronomical energy bills and millions are being pushed into fuel poverty, Atchison said, adding, bosses and shareholders at these big polluters are being allowed to get even richer by exploiting one of our most basic needs. BP is also worsening climate breakdown and extreme weather by continuing to invest and lock us into new oil and gas projects for decades to come. BP's profit report came just hours after U.S. President Joe Biden warned fossil fuel giants that he has prepared to support a windfall profit tax if the companies continue gorging on their own stock while refusing to lower costs for consumers. Biden, in a speech at the White House, said, "Oil companies' record profits today are not because they are doing something new or innovative. Their profits are a windfall of war." Murray Auchincloss, BP's chief financial officer, declined to comment on Biden's speech when pressed by Reuters. In a statement recently, Danielle Willis of the UK-based advocacy group Global Justice Now noted that Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Total Energies have announced combined profits of more than $170 billion this year. To put this into perspective, that is more than $116 billion a year that loss and damage are estimated to cost the Global South to date, Willie said, adding, "It doesn't take much to connect the dots to see what's happening here. When fossil fuel companies are announcing record profits just days before COP27, it's high time leaders join those dots once and for all, too, and make polluters pay up for loss and damage. It's clear they can afford to, and a polluter tax could help reduce household energy bills closer to home as well. People here and the Global South have one thing in common when it comes to companies like BP. They're ripping us off and think they can keep getting away with it at the expense of people and the planet," Willis added. "It's high time we showed them the game is up." RT had a report on the UK energy crisis, writing, "UK households face very, very hard winter. Brits will have to pay twice as much for energy in the coming month," the operator National Grid has warned. "Many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter that could be double what they are accustomed to, despite a government price cap," the National Grid CEO John Pettigrew has warned. In an interview with the Financial Times, he said he was under no illusions and that Brits would find the upcoming winter financially very, very hard. "Even with the taxpayer-funded price cap, this is a doubling up of what people are used to paying for their energy bills," Pettigrew said, adding, "Therefore, inevitably, there are going to be people who are going to struggle." The British government has capped the unit cost of energy until April, meaning that an average household would pay about £2,500 over a year on average. But last winter, the equivalent amount was £1,277. Each household will also receive a £400 rebate on utility bills, with additional means-tested payments through social security benefits. However, that will still be unable to make up the difference given the soaring energy prices. Pettigrew said the National Grid was working on a number of emergency plans to protect the UK against a shortfall of energy from Europe. Earlier, the grid operator's boss warned that the country could face power cuts on really cold evenings this winter due to Europe's continuing energy squeeze. He said that rolling blackouts could happen during those deepest, darkest evenings in January and February, likely between 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Such measures were unlikely, according to Pettigrew, who warned, however, that there were potential scenarios where Britain's power generators would fail to secure sufficient supplies from Europe. "Normally, during the coldest months and extreme weather events, the UK imports gas and electricity from continental Europe for its gas-fired power plants. However, This year, European countries are themselves facing a severe energy crisis, exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Nigeria recently discovered an illegal connection line from one of its major oil export terminals into the sea that had been operating undetected for 9 years. Now, this oil-rich West African nation loses billions of dollars monthly due to theft of oil. The country's navy says major oil multinationals are complicit in this theft. The head of Nigeria's state oil company, NNPC, Mele Kyari, speaks during an operation that uncovered the illegal oil connection.
What you are saying is that your private contractors, civilian contractors, must be aware of this. The GSS around here should have known about it.
Yes.
Shell supervisors should know about it. That's the point you're making.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on massive oil theft in Nigeria, one of the major crude oil producers in the world. The country's navy says multinational oil companies are part of the syndicates in the crude oil theft in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. In the second part of our program, we shall be looking at the issue of the Herero-Nama genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia during the colonial era. Opposition parties in Namibia have rejected the compensation deal offered by Germany and want it renegotiated. Our experts today will give us their incisive analysis of these topics, and you can be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Multinationals stealing Nigeria's oil. Early October, officials in Nigeria discovered an illegal connection line from one of its major oil export terminals into the sea that had been operating undetected for 9 years. The head of Nigeria State Oil Company, Mele Kyari, said the 4-kilometer connection line from the Forcados export terminal, which typically exports around 250,000 barrels per day of oil into the sea, was found during a clampdown on oil theft.
The Nigerian Navy has meanwhile accused international oil companies of being involved in this massive crude oil theft. While to discuss the rampant theft of Nigeria's crude oil and its impact on the country, we have contacted Don DeBer, an activist and commentator. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Now, the Nigerian Navy has reportedly accused multinational oil companies of being involved in the massive theft of the country's crude oil. Now, what's your take on these accusations?
You know, the word theft may be a loaded term, but clearly the people of Nigeria are having their oil stolen by whatever mechanisms, whether it's legal or not. Now, President Muhammadu Buhari last year did a clean sweep of the military officers, the top military officials. And the Navy in particular has gotten itself involved in trying to deal with this. One of the things that he did also, though, was reconstruct the national oil company there, in essence privatizing it, into something that is really bewildering to decide, you know, to try to determine who owns what. And there certainly is an awful lot of room for shenanigans at the moment because it's not transparent.
President Muhammad Buhari has on several occasions expressed outrage over large-scale crude oil theft, saying it was affecting the country's revenues enormously. Buhari has instructed security agencies, especially the military, to speedily clamp down on those involved in oil theft in the Niger Delta.
I also wish to reiterate that we will not allow
a few criminals to have unfettered access to the nation's crude oil supply. Hence, I have directed our security agencies to speedily bring to a halt the activities of these bandits in the Niger Delta. Recent activities on our seas, where large vessels seek to hide in neighboring countries, will be checked.
Nigerian Chief of Naval Staff, Vice Admiral Awal Gambo, says the military is determined to ensure that oil theft and pipeline vandalism were contained. Oil theft in Nigeria has been going on for decades. Experts have expressed doubt over the ability of the country's security forces to effectively end this theft that is posing an existential threat to Nigeria's oil industry.
Nigeria, like almost every nation state on the African continent, is wrapped up in this network of military command and control that has the Pentagon at the center. We've said that we know that 40% of the oil out of Nigeria is coming to the United States. One can assume that some of that or some additional figure is going to the United States illegally. We only have to look at Syria, for example, where the U.S. is illegally occupying a portion of that country. Which portion? The portion where the oil reserves are. You can look at Libya, which was demolished in order to steal the oil reserves. And also, by the way, to remove Libya as an example of what an African country or any country can do to uplift its people using the oil reserves. So, you know, it's difficult to know, first of all, what the intentions are of the people that President Buhari just placed at the command of the military, including the Navy. The hard thing to know is what they can actually accomplish if they actually intend to do something about it in that environment.
The Nigerian National Petroleum Oil Company says it loses $700 million every month as a result of oil theft and vandalism at terminals. United Nations agencies have been urged to designate Nigerian stolen crude oil as blood oil. Now, the loss of oil revenue endangers the achievement of UN Sustainable Development Goals in Nigeria, the most populous country in West Africa. Now, what is the immediate and long-term impact of this oil theft on Nigeria?
Well, okay. So, you know, on the one hand, the GDP of Nigeria is, I forget what, where, somewhere 2 or 3 trillion. It's very large because of the vast amount of petroleum products that are being shipped out. That's a large part of it anyway. $700 million a month, it works out to about $8.4 billion a year. The simple arithmetic, right? You know, to me, it's a simple management problem. With $8.4 billion a year, you could hire, say, all those guys at the airports in the United States that check your shoes to see if it has any, you know, shoe bombs in it or whatever, post people with guns and some of that fancy equipment at the, at a post near each of these points where the oil was literally leaking out the door, and tighten the security. And out of the $8.4 billion, you probably still have $8 billion left over after paying for that. So that could be done. Although $8.4 billion seems like a small amount next to, say, 2 or 3 trillion, like, you know, 3 or 4 tenths of a percent. On the other hand, $8.4 billion out of 225 million people is something like $4,000 for every man, woman, and child in Nigeria. And looking again at the HDI numbers there, and for the income numbers there, that would make a huge impact on the, you know, on the situation of the people in Nigeria.
Stolen Nigerian crude is sold in the international market, after which the proceeds are laundered through world financial centers in Western countries, especially Britain and the United States. Clearly, the pillaging of African resources by Western colonials is going on unabated.
For example, Congo has been on fire since 1960. In the aftermath of the Bandung, the beginning of the non-aligned movement in the early 1950s, and the anti-colonial movement that saw governments, you know, throw off the colonial powers and try to, stand on their own, Patrice Lumumba in Congo, for example, was murdered and chopped into little pieces and made to disappear. Again, as an example to others who might think that way in Africa and Asia and elsewhere. There's, you know, the United States is bigger and scarier now than it ever was on the one hand. But on the other hand, the potential to throw this colonial relations off already has never been greater. The people around the world are starting to hold hands. You can see in terms of oil, for example, the budding relationship between Iran and Venezuela. And also with OPEC plus one or two or three or whatever, standing in solidarity with Russia.
There are five major international oil companies present in Nigeria: Chevron, Eni, ExxonMobil, Shell, and Total Energies. Some of these companies face accusations of complicity in the country's oil theft. The people of Nigeria are fed up and now want action taken. Recently, members of the Petroleum and Natural Gas Senior Staff Association of Nigeria staged rallies over rising cases of crude oil theft.
We are borrowing and putting our children and generations yet unborn in perpetual slavery and in perpetual debt. So we felt that as a nation, we should rise up, and as an association, we should stand to be counted and our voice needed to be heard.
Now, our last question. Isn't it about time that oil multinationals in Nigeria are compelled to account for their crimes? Should they go scot-free while they are stealing billions of dollars from Nigeria every year while the masses in the country languish in poverty?
You know, right now we're looking at Haiti, for example, being invaded again. I made reference before. And again, just to strike the point, on the Human Development Index, Nigeria is one notch below Haiti. Haiti has been punished since 1803, basically, by the West for having the temerity to overthrow the slave masters and to massacre them and claim their independence. It drove a shockwave through the slaveholding world at the time. It was the first slave rebellion that was successful against the European colonial order in the world. And in many people's minds around the world, it still stands as an example. You know, the proximity of the condition of the Nigerian people to that of the people of Haiti on that Human Development Index list may be inciting some ideas in the minds of people who have been trying for generations now to find peaceful solutions to their condition, to be thwarted over and over again by Europe and the United States in particular.
Well, there you have it. The theft of oil in countries such as Nigeria can come to an end if there is firm resolve to stop the looting. I'd like to thank our guest, Don DeBar, for his insight. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on compensation for the Herero Nama genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia during the colonial era. Stay with us.
Namibian opposition want genocide compensation renegotiated.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Tens of thousands of men, women, and children were shot, tortured, or driven into the Kalahari Desert to starve by German troops between 1904 and 1908 after the Herero and Nama tribes rebelled against colonial rule in what was then named German Southwest Africa and is now Namibia.
A descendant of the victims gives a glimpse of what transpired during the genocide.
My great-grandmother used to tell us how people were killed by the Germans and cooked to feed pigs.
Recently, Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as compensation after it officially recognized the Herero-Nama genocide. The government in Germany says the payment is a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations.
Namibia's largest opposition party has rejected the deal. Popular Democratic Movement party leader Marc-Henri Venani has called on Germany to renegotiate the agreement it struck with Windhoek, admitting its role in the genocide during its rule of this southern African nation. Venani says he is ready to work with the government to get a better deal from Germany.
We are ready to play a meaningful dialogue with you as brothers and sisters. So the German authority must come to the party and play a meaningful role in resolving this dialogue. To that end, I have invited the leader of opposition, the CDU leader, Chairman Merz, to come to Namibia. We have lost enough, and we must get a quantum that speaks to the loss that we have lost. And we are ready to play a meaningful dialogue with you as brothers and sisters. So the German authority must come to the party and play a meaningful role in resolving this dialogue.
Now, to discuss the protracted struggle for the compensation of the Namibia genocide perpetrated by Germany, we have contacted Nestor Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thank you for your time today. Now, is the opposition in Namibia justified in rejecting the 1.1 billion euro compensation deal offered by Germany for compensation of the colonial era Herero and Nama genocide?
So this is a pretty complicated issue. I guess some people might be able to look at it as the politics, internal politics of Namibia, where the National Unity Democratic Organization, which is part of the National Assembly, is positioning itself, or at least, positioning itself in the politics of Namibia, juxtaposed to SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, the ruling party. But then it's also a question of the people in Namibia being divided in some ways around this issue. They really were not, as far as they're concerned, included in the negotiations between Germany and the governments between Germany and Namibian government.
On the 2nd of October 1904, colonizers from Germany issued an order for the extermination of the Herero and Nama people, including women and children. Namibians were machine-gunned and their wells poisoned. Those who survived were either driven into the Kalahari or Namib deserts to die, or taken to the concentration camps, such as Shark Island, as prisoners of war. At such camps, they started illegal experiments on the prisoners. This was a horrendous crime committed against the people of Namibia by Germany. Namibians have rejected the current 1.1 billion euro compensation offered by Germany as an insult and want an acceptable deal.
Leaders from the Nama and Herero communities in Namibia say former colonial ruler Germany is not doing enough to make up for the genocide it committed there in the early 20th century. Esther Mwenjangue of the National Unity Democratic Organization is one of the leaders calling for a renegotiation of the genocide compensation deal.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, what is the option left for Namibians if Germany refuses to renegotiate the compensation deal?
I mean, I don't know. I think the options for Namibians if Germany refuses really are up to how organized they can be and how unified they can be, and putting ultimatums to Germany. Also, not just among the Namibia, but also looking at it in terms of the continental unity aspect of Africa. Africa is plagued by, you know, the ravages of neoliberalism and neocolonialism that really can only be withstood by a unified Africa. And so right now, Germany is in a position to really be able to, you know, to refuse things and not really suffer any kind of consequences. And so, with the organization of the masses in Namibia and elsewhere, then there can be consequences, and there should be consequences if they refuse.
The Herero and Nama genocide was the first genocide of the 20th century. Yet Germany offered a half-hearted apology under pressure from Namibians. This conditional apology has been rejected by descendants of the victims.
I couldn't care less about apologies. We are demanding what was taken from us. What was taken from us? Our cattle, our livelihoods, our land. The land that the Germans took from us, they did not take it in a back with to Germany. It's still here. Their children are sitting on our land.
Germany has arrogantly stated that its apology cannot be a legal basis for reparations for the genocide. For many Namibians, such an apology is unacceptable.
This is not the first time that we see your colonial powers refusing to offer apologies to Africans and other non-European, non-white peoples when it comes to their colonization and their genocidal acts against us. And I think the central reason is the same for all of them. To offer, it's one thing to give reparations. It could be seen in the eyes of many as just aid and trying to help give a leg up to the less advantaged people. But to actually acknowledge that you are responsible for something as heinous as the crimes of humanity that colonialism has with all kinds of massacres, then is also to begin to go down the slippery slope of having to acknowledge the responsibility of the current conditions of Africa. It's also just a racist, I would call it, psychological, like phenomena we refer to, like cognitive dissonance. It speaks to, it would be a reflection of, or a, it would be a reflection of what you call delegitimizing their notions of superiority.
We have seen Germans' compensation for the so-called Holocaust survivors amounting to billions of dollars. Now, recently, Germany even paid $662 million to aid Holocaust survivors during the COVID-19 pandemic. This amount is half of what is being paid as full compensation for the monumental Namibia genocide. Now, this is clearly a racist approach in compensation and reparations. Apparently, black lives don't matter for the German government. Do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree that black lives don't matter for any of the Western European powers, particularly those the ruling classes of those countries, those that belong to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We can see its crimes today across the planet. Don't demonstrate that they don't really care about the lives of any non-white people. And so anything they profess, the claims to do so, it's really just public relations ploys. And so that the contradictions and the double standards when it comes to providing aid and different reparations and things like that to other peoples is small in comparison in terms of what reveals the fact that they don't care. Black lives don't matter to them. They never did. And this is a question of power.
Well, there you have it. Western powers really don't care about black lives, and the refusal by Germany to pay reparations for the Herero and Nama people of Namibia is a classic example. I'd like to thank our guest, Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.